This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
There's no place to escape to.
This is the last podcast.
On the left.
Live from your glade.
That's when the cannibalism started.
What was that?
Oh, my fucking pink tents are so full of goblins.
They're full of goblins, huh?
Oh, look at them trying to get out. Hey, wait, ow. Oh, wait a second. Let me feel. Oh, this is just cancer.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that's the worst kind of goblin.
Fuck, I thought my breasts were just turning into M&M chocolate chip cookies, but it's riddled with tumors.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's a horrible way for the doctor to tell you that devastating information. Welcome to the last podcast on the left, everyone. I am Ben, hanging out with Marcus and hanging out with the newly riddled with breast cancer, Henry Zebrowski. I don't know.
And that's how we're going to begin Breast Cancer Awareness Month here on Last Podcast on the Left. Remember, for you big-titted boys out there, check your tits for marbles.
Truly? Yeah. That is true.
Because if you have even, unfortunately, even one marble in there, you got to go to a doctor.
Absolutely. And don't have any shame in it either.
Look, I'm doing it right now. Look at me grab whole handfuls of this.
You should have a little bit more shame in it.
I talked about it on Side Stories this week, how my father looked at my half-nude body in the pool, and he looked at himself, and he's just like, oh my God, Henry Thomas, you got tits just like me.
Yes.
I was like, this took this long?
It's also like kind of an insult, but it's not because he said just like me.
But you're 75 years old, who's essentially dying of emphysema. So you're saying that we got the same body while you have a wasting disease. And technically I do yoga 3 times a week.
All right. Well, the yoga is definitely helping.
Look at me.
You look great. Why goblins?
Why goblins?
Kissing goblins? Ingratiating goblins? In bed with a goblin. That's where we are today.
Oh, that's right.
Classic Alex Jones mixtape. All right, everyone. Today we're covering the Goblin Universe.
It is a universe of goblins.
Indeed.
And we are just pink monkeys at the bottom of it.
No kidding.
Now, the Goblin Universe is a theoretical dimension conceptualized by a writer named Ted Holliday, who wrote equally about the Loch Ness Monster and about angling, boasting both a book called The Great Orm of Loch Ness, published in 1968, and a book called Sea Trout, How to Catch Them, in 1956.
Isn't angling when you stand up in class in eighth grade with a boner and try to make sure no one sees it?
You've talked about this before, and I've still never experienced it. I've kept my boners at home with my computer where they belong. But this book, we're going to talk about, you know, this is one of these, I mean, honestly, you better be half in the bag for this episode, because it's going to require you have to be.
Most people listen driving.
Mentally limber for this episode. This is, there's a lot of weird concepts. We're basically going to talk about how one paranormal theory comes to light.
Okay. Yeah. So essentially, the Goblin Universe was outlined in a book of the same name that was never intended to be published, but a cult superstar writer, Colin Wilson, took it upon himself to publish the book after Ted Holliday died, against Holliday's wishes.
He specifically didn't want people to read this book because, number one, Ted Holliday, who I can only imagine is similar to Ted Pillman, like I imagine Ted Pillman in my mind.
YouTube Ted Pillman.
There's a carload of goblins. I'm saving them for you.
Some deep cuts today.
But he viewed his experiences with the paranormal as tantamount to his life. They changed his entire life. He had many experiences with the paranormal, and they haunted him. And what he was trying to understand towards the end of his life was, what the hell does it all mean? Why does all of this shit happen? Why is it so difficult to get proof of the occult? Why is it so difficult to come up with what's essentially a ground level full theory that encapsulates the entire occult world, which is ghosts, aliens, cryptids, which is what we also tried to do here on Last Podcast on the Left.
Absolutely.
What you find, and what Ted Holliday specifically found, is that it's impossible to do. It makes you, that's number one. Number two, when you talk about it out loud, you sound like what? A moron. Or sound like someone you can't hire. Number
no,
three.
I wouldn't say a moron. You don't sound like a moron. I'd say you sound special. Creative.
Creative.
I'm a creative.
Thank you, Marcus. Thank you for the second word there.
And number three, he didn't come to a conclusion.
No.
And so that's the true reason why he didn't want the book to be published, was because, again, in his pursuit of figuring out what are the limits of this goblin universe, he found that the boundaries were not only blurry, but so were his tools, so were the examples, so was his whole life, because I think he also drank a lot.
I think that's the sign that proves he's using the scientific method. Sometimes you don't get the results you want.
Yeah. Now, because the book, The Goblin Universe, was never meant to be published, it's a bit of a mess, and the ideas are all over the place. So on this one, we're going to go through the book chapter by chapter and discuss some of the ideas contained therein, especially considering how we're getting ready for a doozy of a series starting next week.
So again, this is kind of like an appetizer.
And again, that is, I don't want to blow this again. I said this on the stream yesterday. We're covering COVID. We're going to do a 10-part series on COVID. Oh, it's about time we remember what happened just a couple of days ago.
Technically yesterday.
Yes, and now.
It's not too far off. Well, in the introduction to the book, Colin Wilson gives a bit of a summary of the life of Ted Holliday, starting with Ted's fascination with the Loch Ness Monster.
I hate lakes and I hate what's in them, except if it's fish, and then, you know, at the same time, fish are fucking boring as well.
Apparently, Ted Holliday first saw the Loch Ness Monster in 1962 after becoming fascinated with it as a child in 1933. And this sighting in 1962 came after Ted has spent hundreds of hours searching for it. But after seeing it once, Ted Holliday knew what to look for, and he saw it again several times throughout the 60s.
You notice it by its lovely Loch Ness lady lumps.
Oh,
and that's
indeed.
The true. It's the classic tri-hump, whatever the fuck the Loch Ness Monster you think it is, that thing that comes out of the waves. We covered it a little bit in our Lake Monsters episode, and even a little bit more in our USOs episode that we did last week, where we talk about how mysterious the ocean can be.
How many beer cans? So he's in the middle of the lake, he's on a boat. How many beer cans surround that boat as he slams them? One more for the water.
That's bait.
One more for me. How many do you think he drank there in the middle of the water?
He wasn't a drunk. Henry was just slandering a man. That's my job.
Okay, never mind.
Well, besides the Loch Ness Monster, Ted Holliday was also fascinated with Carl Jung's idea of synchronicity, which is something that we ourselves here at Last Podcast have experienced time and again over the years.
Especially when we are doing episodes. Men in Black, where we talked about how often the visage of Tommy Lee Jones and how it haunted me throughout that entire series. And also when we did the JFK series, episode number 400, when we dropped it, the day we dropped it, also Bob Dylan put out his first single to ever hit number one on the Billboard charts that day as well. His weird mumble rap about JFK. It all happened the same day.
Absolutely. And hopefully this episode we can start giving a little bit of respect to the goblin, because the only movie made about goblins is called Trolls.
It is sad.
So it's time we show some love to the goblin.
But also a big goblin show we want to reach out to, because this episode really is in the spirit of people that have been chasing ultra-terrestrials for forever. Number one, this book is a sister book, as far as I'm concerned, to The Eighth Tower by John Keel, and is also a sister book to Passage to Magonia that was written by Jacques Vallée. But more than often than not, when we talked about our friends, the Newkirks, and their web series that they did, Hellier, that is describing the goblin universe on its own, and what they went for, looking for literal goblins, and it was really about the friends that they made along the way. This story...
It's a great little doc, though.
It really is. It's wonderful. But this story is about this concept of when you go searching for mysteries, and as Ted Holliday describes it himself, is that you find that the mysterious part of the universe is like an actor that wears all masks at once for all of his performances. But that sometimes when the actor removes each one of those masks.
He's on trial for something horrible.
No, what you start to see, what you begin to see is yourself.
Mm. Okay, okay.
Furthermore, Holiday was also interested in Jung's ideas about UFOs, namely that they weren't real, but were actually projections of the human mind,
yeah,
a portent of long-lasting transformations of the collective human psyche.
They're there to teach us about ourselves because, I mean, why else would they be there? Because it's just, you know, because it's all about us, Kissel.
Everyone did agree with my assessment of time and light as well, by the way. 75 million, that's what... So when it gets back to the alien planet, they don't even... There's footage that they're collecting right now, they're not going to see it for 750 million years.
You were right one time, like Greta Thunberg was right one time to be scared of the ocean.
Extrapolating from Jung and other sources, Holiday began to believe that there were connections between UFOs, mythical beasts, paranormal entities, and ley lines. And of course, ley lines are straight paths of quote-unquote energies that connect various historical structures and landmarks around the globe.
But he did good work on that, though.
That's
this is
cool,
the ley line stuff is I thought was more interesting in this book than I've read in other books.
Is true question with the ley line stuff? You know, the if you look at Washington D.C., there's like a pentagram thing that forms.
Bro.
Is that's not a ley line, is it?
No,
it's Masonic influence, bro.
All right, dude.
No, a ley line is like how you can trace a straight line from from the Nazca lines in Peru over to Stonehenge.
Okay,
yeah, I mean
that sort of stuff.
Some of it's bullshit.
Yeah.
But when he loops in the idea of the idea of feng shui and the idea of natural energy sources, and when he talks about the idea is that it's not straight lines, that it's kind of geological formations can maybe call towards specific phenomena.
Okay.
It's the idea that places like Stonehenge are built on areas of energy, you know, like that they are that people are attracted to certain areas of the earth to build these, you know, ancient landmarks for whatever reason. The
magnetized
ancient aliens crowd.
Nickel.
Yeah,
magnetized nickel.
Uh-huh.
Did you talk about it? It's magnets,
sure.
Bro.
Okay.
How do they work?
You just brought those two words out of nowhere, and you're yelling at me.
Natural aquifers.
Okay,
come closer, ma'am. Natural aquifers.
Okay.
I will show you the natural aquifer I have in my shorts.
Next time, let's just go through the drive-through.
Okay.
Well, extrapolating from ley line research, and there's going to be a lot of extrapolating here with no real conclusion, Ted Holiday went further into the past and saw that old carvings in Christian churches and certain dragons of mythology held certain similarities with modern Western concepts of flying saucers. But Ted was not necessarily approaching all this from an ancient alien's perspective, which is, of course, you know, the chariot of the gods model. It says that nuts and bolts aliens have been visiting Earth for millennia to fuck around with humanity's development.
Mm-hmm. I think that it was kind of refreshing that he debunked Eric Von Daniken in these books, because it's important to remember, because now we know truly that the ancient alien idea is completely wrong. Like the idea that they had
condescending.
It's condescending because what we now know is that the pyramids, all of these things were built by, were they still just people slathered with blood on the side of the pyramids who got whipped to death? Absolutely. But they were artists. And they weren't necessarily just slaves. They just were out there building all of these things after generation after generation of people that were sort of descended into building these things. And it's just amazing what fucking 100 generations of people can create.
I don't want to blow your mind, but I just saw some cave paintings from multiple hundreds of years ago that showed semen going into an egg.
That's porn.
No, I'm just saying they were smarter than we think. Everyone thinks that we're the smartest, and I don't know if that's true.
No, we ain't that much smarter.
No, we have the exact same brains that we had 6,000 years ago. We have not evolved at all.
Okay.
We're taller, but that's about it.
Great.
Some of us.
Well, instead of the ancient aliens theory, Ted began to believe that dragons, lake monsters, flying saucers, mythological creatures, fairies, magic, ghosts, and cryptids couldn't all be figments of people's imaginations, which led him to believe that reality is altogether stranger and more complex than we think. So, to explain all of the strange phenomena that he'd himself witnessed and read about, as well as all the strange phenomena that everyone else had seen, he came up with a unifying theory to try and explain where all of it came from. And therefore, the Goblin universe was born.
Oh.
I'm going to read the quote that got him to call his concept the Goblin universe, because I think it's really interesting, because it does come from an actual an actual famous biologist, Professor John Napier, who was the director of the primate biology program in the Smithsonian. He had this statement that I think is really, really interesting.
Well, the way I see it at the moment is this. Reason tells us these things do not exist. Yet the only apparent alternative is that the whole affair is a great conspiracy. I am not prepared to entirely ignore eyewitnesses, nor accuse them of being part of the great conspiracy. In fact, I'm sure they are truthful, and that there is no such thing as a great conspiracy. There must be a third explanation, which is neither A, a matter of reason, nor B, fakery. This must be unreasonable in our terms, but probably makes sense in the goblin universe.
Wow.
Essentially, the third explanation must concern the minds of men.
I love that.
He said it!
That is really cool. That's the titular line. You sound like Wyatt Lump. I love it. It's a nice southern sound. Chewing tobacco.
This whole book is about the frustration of how many people come forward and they say that they see an alien. How many people come forward and say that they know that they've seen a ghost, that a ghost has physically touched them, that they have and it's not just
their
visual.
Their father was a professional wrestler?
That's only if they're a really good wrestler.
Oh, that's true.
That's when they get the real first class approach from a coach.
That's true.
But it's also all of these shit, right? The people say they see lake monsters. They see all this shit. And you have all these people come forward. They ruin their lives to say, I was there. I was abducted. I've seen these things. But there's no proof. And so forever, all of the people on the more conservative side of the internet, all of you out there that I know are listening, were like,
that's the reason why, because there is no proof. And that's how you know it's fake.
Which is how you sound to me, but I also know that you have your belief system, which is your own belief system, this idea that you need this sort of like empirical pictures. You need a sample of Bigfoot dung, which I do get that you want this. But this is all about how do we thread the needle here between the constant, never-ending experience of the witnesser and the eyewitness and the people that have experienced these things, and then the fact that we can't prove it.
I don't know if you should criticize people so much. They're just looking for evidence.
Yeah, like a bunch of amateurs.
Yeah.
All right. I understand that you want evidence. I totally get it. But I guess I love to sit in the gray,
but Henry, are we not men? Are we not men of the mind?
I am.
Are we not men of concepts?
Look at my shorts.
Yes, they're very short.
Well, Ted Holliday believed that one day all paranormal phenomena would be as readily explained as math and science. Oh. And by applying a scientific view of the paranormal universe, one would cease to be an occultist and they would become a scientist.
Hell yeah, that's what I'm going for, bro.
Yeah. To quote Ted Holliday, we inhabit a strange cosmos where nothing is absolute, final, or conclusive. Truth is an actor who dons one mask after another and then vanishes through a secret door in the stage scenery when we reach out to grab him. Oh. All he leaves behind is a sardonic chuckle which we record, take away, analyze, and debate. But we never see his face.
You know what, man? I'm just happy this community theater presentation was free.
It does feel, when you do hear him describe it like that, I do feel like we're going to see the landlord show, like in the Big
Lebowski. Of course,
Big
Lebowski. Which I need to see something like that ASAP. I can't wait. If you have a theatrical performance coming up, shoot it my way. You never know when a stoned Ben Kissel will just be in the back being like, that was incredible.
See, according to Ted, the goblin universe is the place in the play where the actor, the so-called goblin, switches one mask for another. Am I correct in saying that the actor is the goblin?
Let's just say yes and move on, please.
It's about yes. I'd say the goblin is the phenomena, right? Yeah. The idea of whatever is you're seeing and the fact that it can go from one form to another very easily.
Yeah. Well, Bigfoot switches masks to become Nessie, who switches masks to become an alien, who switches masks to become a poltergeist. But Ted Holliday also contradicts himself later in the preface, saying that the actor, or goblin, does not wear different masks successively, but rather wears all the masks at the same time, which means that it is the person seeing the goblin that gives the goblin form. harm.
But, or the way I would interpret that is that it's the actor wears all masks of all time. Because it's not that he's changing. It's that it's always been all of it. And that whatever you're seeing is that literally a Bigfoot sighting is exactly the same as seeing as a ghost, which is exactly the same as seeing aliens.
Well, that's, I mean, from what I can understand, if people are going to Loch Ness expecting to see the Loch Ness monster, when they peek into the Goblin universe, Nessie is what they see. Likewise, a person visiting a Civil War battleground goes expecting to see a ghost soldier. So when they peek through the Goblin universe, they see a bloody Confederate soldier. It's all the same thing, but it's all about perceptions.
I completely understand now that we have total monetization of fast food chains. You notice all of the food is the exact same at Taco Bell or whatever is also owned by Taco Bell, the parent company. It's all the same meat. It's all the same cheese.
He's breaking through.
I understand.
You just got
blackpilled
on fast food.
I did, but I get it now. So it's all goblins all the time. It's whatever you see, but it's the same creator.
I just think, again, all of this is about the human mind. And that I think that what we're going to find out next week when this UFO report comes out, they are now saying
about this. I don't think it's coming out, bro.
They are saying it's coming out. And now the Pentagon is saying, they're coming out and saying, it's an interdimensional thing you wouldn't understand, which is them just saying they don't understand.
It's like the party hole. I get it.
It is like the party hole. Exactly. You're watching Pretty Face. But it's that shit where it really comes down to, why are we seeing this? Why are we seeing these things? What does it mean? Because to me, there's a story here that is as old as humankind. And it's not just about people being full of shit. Because I do believe, yes, I'll give you 65%.
Wow.
That's what I'm going to say. That's the Henry Zebrowski AP poll of people who are full of shit about these things. I'm going to say 65%. But that leaves, even if 1% is real, then that means that there is something that has been shadowing the human experience since we've had consciousness. Mm-hmm. Which, again, it's not about maybe seeing other things. We were talking to an astrophysicist this morning for the LPN show, and I was asking her about exoplanets and why we haven't found nuts and bolts UFOs yet, and like why we haven't found these other biological things that exist. First of all, her main answer was that the universe is just too big, and we'll never see them unless they specifically show themselves. Mm-hmm. And number two, she straight up said, we're in this quote-unquote simulation, right? Like this idea, whatever that means, because technically, if it doesn't change what you eat for lunch every day, it doesn't matter whether you're in your civilization, whether you're in a simulation or not, right? Come closer to me. So we keep seeing this shit, though. So if it's not a ship or whatever from some other place, it has something to do with us and what we've talked about in the live show last week, too. The call's coming from inside the house, then.
Well, I mean, Ted wrote that reason tells us that these things don't exist. Like, no reasonable person could say that the Loch Ness Monster exists or the Bigfoot exists or anything like that. But since people have seen these things, then it leaves no alternative but to conclude that there's some sort of great goblin conspiracy with unknown motivation.
Man, I want to be the Dick Cheney of that.
You're becoming that.
So after explaining the concept of the Goblin universe in the preface, Ted Holliday then begins laying out his case chapter by chapter, starting with personal paranormal experiences in chapter one. He has to give his pedigree.
Okay.
In this chapter, he speaks of a family by the surname of Dennis who experienced invisible strangers moving about their house, accompanied by the sounds of boots and wheezing. Apparently, the former residents, the Johnsons, had died in the house, and the Dennis children would regularly draw pictures of the apparitions they saw, including, quote,
a fat little man with a red face, with a walking stick who keeps waking me up and standing by my bed.
Oh my God, that's horrifying.
Hey, okay, you want to be on a podcast?
What?
Yeah, we're trying to pitch podcast to Nickelodeon.
Oh my God, please.
Well, interestingly, the Dennis family nicknamed the ghost Alfred, and not even an exorcism was able to dislodge the ghost from the home, nor was Ted Holliday able to do anything for this family beyond observation. So it's an experience with no conclusion.
True question. How does a ghost go on a diet?
How?
I don't know. Like,
this is again. Oh,
I thought you were setting it up for a fucking like horrible joke.
Yeah, no, that's a true question. Yeah. No, how does a ghost? If it's a fat ghost, if you die fat, do you always? You have to be a fat ghost too.
Yes.
Yeah.
You have to lose weight before you die.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like you have to work OT.
You can't get your dream
build up your pension before you retire.
You can't get your dream body after you even die.
No,
you can't,
man,
carve your ghost fat?
No, no, no. You get to choose nothing. Absolutely okay. Nothing. You sweet, innocent young boy. No. You're going to have to lose weight before you die if you want to fuck in heaven. But you still, people want to fuck you. They want to fuck you all the time, Kissel. They want to see you. They want to ride you. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So you don't got to change a single thing about yourself.
Yeah, man. I'm a real carnival cruise.
A few years before his experience with the Dennis family, Ted Holliday investigated paranormal activity in a mansion in Pembrokeshire, where an Irishman with heavy boots haunted the grounds.
Ooh.
I loved his description of the steps that the ghost would take, and that he said that this is one of those things, again, which I think is interesting, that comes up time and time again with the examples that he set forth, is sounds and soundscapes, smells, stuff like that. The things that set an atmosphere for these experiences are very similar. And one is this concept idea of people have said the term hollow steps. Mm. And he said, he's like, you can really hear it because this was a house that was retrofitted and redone. So it used to have stone steps back in the day, right? Like whenever the house was first built. But now it has carpeted steps. But he said the steps he heard, the only way he could describe it was big, heavy boots on a stone staircase that was very echoey. He said it sounded like someone had recorded it with a microphone and then had played the sounds to him. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Well, when Ted Holliday stayed the night, he said that a blow hit the headboard of his bed. And at the same time, a man with a Belfast accent asked,
"And who the hell are you?"
No. With that, like, remember the
and
fall.
Who the hell are you? And who the hell are you?
No, it's like the fall. It's like, and who the hell are you?
That's good.
Thank
that
you.
Is very good. Yeah. Sounds kind of sounded a little bit like Ren.
Live from your grave.
My sister is the best gift giver I've ever met of any person. It's Jackie Zabrowski. She shops all year, thinking about her family and friends, and puts little things aside for their birthdays and Christmases. I have no idea how she does it. I don't know how she do it. But guess what? She always wins Mother's Day, but not this year. I'm coming back. Ready to win Mother's Day and cement your reputation as the best gift giver in the family? I'm taking the crown. All right, give the moms in your life an Aura digital picture frame preloaded with decades of family photos. I mean this. We have the Aura frame up in my home. We absolutely love it. I can put photos on it very, very easily through the app. It's fun to do. And the memories keep cycling and I get emotional. And we filled it with pictures of Carmi and Wendy. And that is not sad. That is celebratory. So you should try it. It's honestly a really good product. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code LEFT at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Finding work-life balance can be tough, but Squarespace gives you the tools to reach your goals and have time to celebrate. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. With the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint, you can select from curated layout and styling options to create a personalized website optimized for every device. Get your website discovered fast with integrated, optimized SEO tools. Plus, make checkout easy for customers with easy-to-use payment tools. And with Squarespace AI, you can explain what your site is about, choose your tone, enter what you need, and get auto-generated text. And that helps you save time. I know I'm sitting on about 2 literal wheelbarrows filled with horse pics. Now, part of the issue has been is a lot of these pictures are getting stopped at customs because some of them do depict various world leaders in horse-like circumstances that seems to be pinging a lot of these custom agents' accounts. Now, so what I've done to do is like, so while I'm trying to work on hand smuggling these horse pics over various country borders, I then also have time, because Squarespace is doing all the other ad work for me, to go and work on my killdozer at home. So thank you, Squarespace, for allowing me to diversify in the best way possible for this country. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial when you're ready to launch. Go to squarespace.com/left to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
So after establishing a bit of a paranormal pedigree, Ted Holliday moves on to the subject of reincarnation for Chapter 2, and how reincarnation might fit into the Goblin universe, specifically the subject of the reincarnation of evil.
Oh. This is a chapter that I felt didn't really need to be in there, but it did.
It's interesting, though. It's interesting stuff.
It is very interesting. I love this story, though.
Yeah. Well, for a particularly grisly example, Holliday chose to compare alleged 15th century serial killer Gilles de Rais a 20th century child rapist from the UK named Edward Paisnell, a.k.a. the Jersey Monster.
The Jersey Monster!
implying that these two men were one and the same. Now, we're going to do a full episode on Gilles de Rais, possibly this year as a part of our summer series.
It's a fantastic story.
It would fit in quite wonderfully with all that. But to give a quick overview, Gilles de Rais was said to be a former knight who got a taste for blood as a leader of the French army and as a companion of Joan of Arc. But once military action ceased, de Rais' bloodlust only increased.
It's actually one of the original stories kind of talking about post-traumatic PTSD and what it means like throughout all time, and how, like, according to certain interpretations of Gilles de Rais' life, he spent so long killing and being a killing machine that you can't just turn it off when you come back.
Absolutely.
Now, admittedly, I don't know the full truth of the Gilles de Rais story just yet, but Ted Holliday claimed that de Rais was a black magician who brought sorcerers to his castle in hopes of raising demons and eventually the devil himself.
The devil himself!
Don't do that!
And it's so hard to get the devil. Do you have any idea how busy the devil is?
He is booked up!
From what reports claimed, a magician named La Riviere summoned a demon in the form of a leopard, and will certainly be getting into the big cat connection with the Goblin universe later on.
You think cats weren't a part of this? Then you were actually reasonable.
Wow.
But as the story goes, children from the surrounding villages around De Rais' castle began disappearing, and the bodies of 80 children were eventually discovered in and around De Rais' lands. From reports, they were boys and girls, but mostly boys, between 9 and 17 years old, and the order of the day was sodomy, beheading, neck-breaking, and strangulation, while the remains were burned in huge fireplaces in the castle, and the bones were flung into the moat. By estimates, up to 200 children may have died in this manner.
See, this is back in the day. If you're a serial killer, you also have, like, servants and shit.
Yeah.
So Gilles de Rais was extremely rich, and he was a well-connected aristocrat. So he had, like, employees that would help him kill people. So that's how you get those numbers up.
Of course. I'm sure Dahmer had, like, some mice he talked to in his Milwaukee apartment.
I mean, honestly, I feel like that Dahmer could have probably found one willing accomplice if he really wanted to, because when it comes down to it, who's not looking for a little summer vacation from their job? You know what I mean?
Yeah, Dean Kroll had a couple of interns.
That's true.
John Wayne Gacy probably also had one or two himself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But even though de Rais was a confessed monster, he was also extraordinarily powerful and spent years bribing noblemen to cover up his crimes, all while launching a play about his heroic deeds with Joan of Arc, which cost over £1 million in 15th century money.
Wow.
Dude, that's an incredible story. He choreographed, directed, and wrote. What they said was nowadays would be close to like $20 million, like some like crazy sum for a play that had 500 people in it, soldiers, all this kind of shit. I was like, that sounds fucking sweet.
Who would
have thought? Spider-Man After Dark?
Who would have thought a wealthy producer that committed mass crimes trying to do it all publicly as well as an ultimate fuck you?
Oh my God, I didn't even think about it.
It's disgusting.
Oh my God, holy shit.
No, he did.
Well, eventually, de Rais was caught out when he fucked with the church, which is not something you did back then. The ensuing investigation supposedly uncovered his crimes, and de Rais confessed and was quickly hanged and burned for everything that he did, supposedly. Hmm. Now, there are doubts as to whether this entire affair was merely a smear campaign by the church, and it might have been that the church was working in conjunction with the local government, because the prosecutor in this case was giving all of de Rais' land after the conviction.
Interesting. That might be a motivation to prosecute.
It might be.
But even so, Ted Holliday still... And really, we're going to be getting into the full Gilles de Rais story later on, because it is a fascinating... Like, I just gave you the fucking... The
little
skim,
snippets.
A tiny little skim of that entire story. It's a fascinating story.
Also, I love the idea of doing the view from the side of Joan of Arc.
Yeah.
Because that story is also very interesting, but I think it's mostly going to be another, like... story that's been blown out of proportion. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to really see what the center of the Joan of Arc tale is. Because, you know, do we believe that she was talking directly to God? Or was she just a precocious, like, we need to go to France and kill everyone?
Yeah, it's probably that. It's probably the latter.
Like, I like the little girl.
She was French.
Oh, whatever, man. I
mean, she's dead now.
Oh, yeah, she's dead. Who gives a shit?
I don't know.
Hell yeah, man.
Do you have accents as a ghost?
Nailed it.
But even so, Ted Holliday still made the connection between the accused Gilles de Rais and a very real sadistic pedophile named Edward Paisnell, who terrorized the Isle of Jersey in the late 70s, all because the two shared some interesting synchronicities.
I also don't want to bust this story because this is another episode that we should do.
Let's just give it a skim here.
I think we're fine with a skim on this one. This is fucking awful.
Okay.
First of all, Edward Paisnell was married to a woman named Joan, which echoes the connection between De Rais and Joan of Arc. And apparently, Edward's Joan was quite puritanical, which, you know, echoes Joan's devotion to God. And she grew the same mandrakes in her garden that magicians used in medieval times. Perhaps the same mandrakes that magicians in Gilles de Rais' castle may have used.
Coincidence.
Also, his first wife was named Joan as well. He was married to two Jones.
Two Jones?
Wow. Reportedly, he kidnapped and tied up 21 children by their necks and sodomized them. Didn't kill any of them. Just fucking sodomized them and let them go.
Yep.
And at least one of the attacks took place on Rue de Rais, which was once owned by who else but the de Rais family.
This is the part. This next part is the part. I mean, obviously, it's supposed to be disturbing.
It's supposed to be disturbing.
It definitely is, yeah.
Paisnell used to wear a costume during his attacks, what he called his beast costume. It was made up of a woman's black wig, a wristband studded with nails, a jacket studded with more nails so his victims couldn't grab a hold of him without grabbing nails, and he wore a homemade rubber mask, which is somewhat similar to Leatherface's mask, but scarier.
Jesus Christ, this guy was a real-life monster.
Have you seen pictures of him?
No, I have not seen pictures of him, although you wait until next year's Fashion Week when nails are in and everyone is just wearing nothing but nail jackets.
It's the unapproachable look.
Yes, indeed.
Look at this shit. You can all show you this right now. Look at this fucking
costume. We'll post a picture on our Instagram page as well.
Honestly, he kind of looks like Johnny Depp. He's got a little bit of an Edward Scissorhands vibe when wearing a mask. Holy shit.
Oh my God,
that dude is truly horrifying.
It's
truly horrifying.
Rapist scissor vest.
Yeah. that's what it looks like, a more perverted Edward Scissorhands. I guess he wasn't perverted, though, Edward. He just wanted to help out the community.
He was just a machine. He didn't ask to be made.
I'm with you. I took it back immediately.
But according to Ted Holliday, this flair for the theatrical also echoed Gilles de Rais' own penchant for staging elaborate plays about his own heroic deeds. Furthermore, both men were vegetarians. A book on witchcraft and a ritual dagger was found at Paisnell's home, and when Paisnell was caught by police, he said that a couple of hundred years ago, he would have been burned alive for what he'd done, possibly some sort of memory.
Yeah, I feel like even now he'd also be burned alive for what he's done, because, I mean, it wasn't nice, but he only got 30 years.
Well, I think that you could take him for his word and just burn him alive there. I would say dealer's choice.
Yeah.
Dealer's choice.
He got out of jail and he died outside
of jail. The man that I just
saw
a picture of?
Yeah, he died. He said apparently he couldn't get along in his neighborhood.
Oh,
I don't know why.
What?
And then he died in his own house in 1994.
Did he go on to produce Shakespeare in Love as well?
Well, going off of this supposed reincarnation, Ted Holliday told another story from 1972 in which five schoolboys experimented with magic and one boy became possessed by his dead grandfather and attacked his friends with a knife before trying to strangle them.
This is one of those stories that they used to tell on the news to get you afraid to do D&D. Like, yeah. I don't believe in this
one. Of course not. No.
Yeah.
No, this is like the vision that Ted Holliday paints of the 70s makes it a truly fucking horrifying place. Like, he paints a vision of, like, where witchcraft is real and everywhere at all times.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. You can't go one block without seeing a fucking witch, and I'll tell you what, I can't go five blocks without seeing my fucking ex-wife.
Whoa, is that name? Is her name Joan as well?
Yeah, she fucking more like Moan. Fucking wow. Ghost to me. I wish I could kill. They keep coming back.
You're a classy guy.
2 years later, a mother reported that her child was slashing herself with a fork and attacked a baby, seemingly without provocation or motivation. And all these events, Holliday said, pointed towards a kind of evil reincarnation emanating from the goblin universe.
Oh, that was a stretch. It's a stretch. That's the chapter that needed the most work. Because it didn't, because I didn't know what it was looping all the way. I don't know how it looped back, but it was basically him trying to say more like, what do you think of this?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds fascinating.
Yeah. So after making that loose point, Holliday moved on to chapter 3, which is mostly about time. And really, it's about prognostication and how people who can see just a bit into the future and people who can see centuries ahead, like Nostradamus, are simply getting views of differing sizes into the goblin universe. A pinhole versus a manhole.
Okay.
But Nostradamus is full of shit.
Was
the Hister stuff was like, that's the one thing that he was sort of onto. That the Nostradamus stuff that he talks about is like the most dated stuff in this book, I think.
Yeah.
And then, but the one thing that I thought was interesting is that it does speak to PKD's experience with vowels.
Philip K.
PKD
Dick.
PKD is Philip K. Dick. Not everyone
Nobody knows
that PKD.
Because the P is silent.
The only reason why I know it's PKD is because I'm your friend. Otherwise, I would not know.
The audience is my friend. If they've gotten this far, they know who PKD is.
I don't think you've ever said PKD before.
I say it every day.
To yourself.
To my family.
Indeed.
But PKD, he had an experience with an intelligence that he said zapped information into his mind and made him realize that he was seeing visions when he wrote books that showed that he wasn't writing fiction. He was channeling alternative presence. Yeah. And that he said that he had an experience where he traveled back in time to the Roman eras, where he saw himself in that time period. He wrote about himself he called himself Horse Lover Fat in that time period, because I believe Philip means horse lover, like a lover of horses in German, and Dick means fat in German. So he created word for it, right? And that, like Mr. Hans, he was a real horse lover.
Yeah, he was.
Dead
he
now.
Fucked to death by a horse nicknamed Big Dick.
And then this is what he's saying. The exegesis, I don't know if we'll get to it someday. But the exegesis is his full-on spiraling breakdown of this concept of there is no such thing as linear time.
I mean, it is also the plot of Army of Darkness.
Yeah, man. I mean, technically, that's the coolest version of that story.
Oh,
yeah.
I love that movie.
I love that movie.
No, it's where Man in the High Castle comes from. He looked into an alternate universe where the Nazis won, you know, and he was just able to go beep, beep, beep.
Oh,
beep,
God,
beep.
Don't even trigger me with that shit. Remember when the subways in New York were all covered in Nazis?
Yes.
There was the ad campaign for that fucking thing. they covered subways with just Nazi propaganda. It's a massive Jewish community, and then we have to take the trains, and it was just...
It's just really traumatizing.
Man, when I read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich on the train, like, I ripped the cover off so I wouldn't be riding around reading a book with a gigantic fucking swastika on it.
No, it's an old Buddhist symbol. I'm actually trying to take the symbol back.
Live from your grave.
Well, after a brief discussion on time, Holliday moves on to the idea that UFOs and fairies are pretty much the same thing. But within that chapter are even more interesting ideas. Specifically, he says that maybe the universe isn't as random as we think it is. And sometimes the universe shows us its intentions.
Every day, you put it out in the world. You write it on a bottle of water and you drink it. You get it inside of you.
Absolutely.
That's the dumbest shit I've ever heard.
Yeah, it doesn't work. No, Marcus, is because you're being, you won't let it in. You won't white light it. You have to sit, think about it. If you want happiness, write it in a piece of paper, you put it on the water. The water thinks, and then you drink it, you get happiness from the water.
What if I fucking wrote it on a hamburger wrapper and then ate the hamburger? Would that work?
You're being sarcastic.
That would also work, though.
Yeah. Well, for example, Holiday wrote that in 1974, the Prime Minister of England posed for a picture with author John Dyson, who had just written a book called The Prime Minister's Boat is Missing.
That's cute.
And 5 days after the photo, the Prime Minister's boat went missing.
Can you hold on a second?
So it wasn't an allegory? This was literally about the Prime Minister's boat going missing? This wasn't about poor leadership or anything like that? Like all the president's men? It was just about his boat?
I want to say it was like a crime novel that has like a funny title.
Yeah. Now, really, the theory that UFOs are fairies did not originate with Ted Holiday. Instead, this is a theory first put forth by our man, Jacques Vallée. And Henry will now take the lead on explaining this UFO fairy connection.
I'm starting the timer, by the way.
I'm just going to put it out there lightly. I just want to say, honestly, if you've been listening to this show for just this episode for this long, if we haven't lost you already, I want you to go and buy Passport to Magonia and read it. Because Passport to Magonia is Jacques Vallée's entire breakdown of what they call the trooping fairies, which is this idea that this phenomenon...
Sounds like a sex act.
It is. It's a lot of times, because how many times these fairies used to take people up and rape them, steal their cum, and then make babies and drop them off, call them changelings. It's the same thing as the hybrid fairies.
Nice.
No, all they did was suck dick against your will, bro.
What?
They used to talk about...
They would give you gifts that were supposedly gold, and the gifts would turn to ash.
Some people,
when they came into contact with fairies, they would get what was called elf cake, which is a hardening of the skin. They also called it elf disease. It was a dermatological issue, which also happens in some UFO abductees, specifically Antonio Villas-Boas.
You remember Antonio Villas-Boas that had the penis hair wrapped around so hard around his penis and it caused him discomfort? You know who also had penis problems? Barney Hill. He also had those penis lumps. John Keel, throughout the Eighth Tower, talks about how often aliens attack the penis and how the penis is always either engorged so much with the priapism that the erection hurts. It really, really hurts.
Sure.
And it can last for days after seeing an alien, much like when I saw Gillian Anderson in person at the Webby's.
Yes.
And I had to go to the doctor. And I didn't want her curse.
Well, she had to be escorted away from you by security.
She acknowledged me. We've talked about this.
Yeah.
But it is this concept that this phenomena has been following us a long time. And again, it's the trickster phenomena, which is this idea that you desperately want to prove to the world that you have seen what, you know, in the 18th century, you will have seen something that looks like a fairy or a man dressed as a bard. Cut to the 19th century, the UFOs look like steam machines. They look like things that look appropriate to the time period. They all advance. You see people that look like they're more so like they're using the top technology of your specific time period. And then now we see greys and we see reptilians, and that the main concept is that it's all exactly the same thing, which is a phenomenon that seems to exist partly from our mind, and it is about us. It's about us learning how to essentially, this is a phenomena that may or may not be outside of our own mind. If it is an intellectual thing, if it is something outside of us, some form of intelligence, what they're trying to do is bring us to them. Like this idea that maybe we are supposed to evolve. We're supposed to learn from them. The idea that life is not so simple. Life
what
is
are we
not
supposed to
just-
learn how to tie hair around our dick and make it really tight?
If you want to take that lesson, Kissel, then I think it's any lesson that they can get in.
I do picture the little fairies being like the birds in Cinderella, tying the pubic hair around somebody's dick and like kind of singing and stuff.
I mean, I think that I've seen that pornography film.
Well, it's the concept that, you know, fairies back then are the same as UFOs now, but they share a lot of similarities. You know, it's things like way back when you would see fairy rings on the ground, which is a circle of burnt grass, and people back then said, hey, it's fairies hanging out. This is what happens when fairies hang out. And now we say, oh, that's where a UFO lands. And likewise, you would also see dancing lights in the sky, which people said, oh, that's fairies. And now when we see things like the Phoenix lights, we say that's UFOs, but it's the same thing. It's just the mask is changing.
You mentioned those dancing light in the sky, but I think that's just them celebrating the reunion of friends.
Well, thank God nice? They're all together and isn't they all have nice? The same face. I already said that on Side Stories.
Kind of.
So after going through the UFO fairy connection, Ted Holliday moved on to the mystery of big cats.
Yeah, they hate Mondays.
That's not a mystery. Big cats exist.
Bigger than normal cats.
What do you mean? Yeah. Like
too big.
Yeah. Oh my, like the one He-Man used to ride?
Yeah, like that okay. big.
That's a bigger cat.
Yeah.
But no, like too big.
What do you mean too big?
Like a house cat looking thing that's your size. People see big cats. It's like people seeing giant birds, the Thunderbirds. Okay. People seeing giant sloths, thunder sloths. People see, that's weird, they do call them that. Yeah, people seeing giant worms. People seeing giant dogs. This is the thing that comes about.
Maybe they're just really tiny, the people that see them.
No, maybe it's when you see, it's like you see a cat and you go, that cat's too big.
It's too
and
big.
It weirds you out.
Okay.
And it weirds you out.
Okay, I got it.
Well, Ted Holliday wrote that in the Book of Kells, which is a 9th century manuscript containing the four Gospels of the New Testament, there is an interesting depiction of St. Patrick. In this manuscript, St. Patrick is seen with his feet planted on a great serpent and a large cat, which are both astral entities that, in Holliday's opinion, represent a higher function of the human psyche. As Holliday puts it, these representations helped people understand their place in the universe and helped them to understand that there are other planes of existence. Furthermore, he wrote that it is no coincidence that increasing reports of paranormal events are coinciding with decreasing devotions to organized religion.
Well, quite often it sounds like it's in a and that's where I understand the criticism where it sounds like a replacement because way I think it is. It is a replacement.
It's faith-based in its own way, that's for sure.
Well, I think what he's trying to say is that, you know, people will see the Goblin universe no matter what. But as the mask changes from a Christianity lens to something closer to pop culture, we see less visions of angels and saints and more visions of UFOs and ghosts.
And Miley Cyrus on that wrecking ball. I love Miley.
That's 6 years old now.
I know.
Oh, wow.
That's not even current.
I like it, though. I like it.
That's current. Miley is always current.
Miley
she's
is
a pop
current.
Superstar. It's like Madonna.
See ya. JoJo Siwa. I said that name yesterday too.
I don't think JoJo's not there yet. I don't think. Well,
no, I don't think so. I don't know what she does.
Well, tying this in, Holliday shared a lot of apocryphal tales of people seeing big cats that vanish into thin air, which isn't normally seen in, say, UFOs. UFOs fly away. Big cats just go poof.
Oh.
And in this, Holliday suggests that perhaps these big cats exist without a mask and inhabit both the Goblin universe and this one and can freely walk between the two.
So all we need is lonely divorced women to take care of all of this?
If only
is it just
the cougars.
It's cats?
If only the cougars could help us. A lot of times, those cougars just make things more complicated.
You think they're going to solve all your problems? They just introduced 5 more, my friend.
Whoa!
Gerda Jeff. The man loses. The man gets 10 new ideas, he loses 10 old ideas.
Is that something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, extrapolating off that, Ted Holliday introduces what he calls the Phantom Menagerie in Chapter 6, which is one of my favorite concepts of the whole book.
Okay.
Now, the Phantom Menagerie is the umbrella that all paranormal and mythological creatures, from dragons to Bigfoots to serpents to yetis to mermaids, all exist under. These creatures, from Holliday's perspective, are more animal-like than human, but do not behave as ordinary animals. They do not breed, nor do they eat or build dens, but they do share one aspect of the animal world. They can become extinct.
There is an interesting perspective from the Eighth Tower. That is, John Keel, again, all of this is pretty old-timey at this point, but I really think that all of these are important things to read if you really want to put your big old paranormal investigator cap on. This is the type of shit that you should be as versed in as ghost machines or the infrared bullshit, like all of the stuff that you want to get empirical evidence. I think that's necessary, right? Trying to get empirical evidence. But I think this stuff is really important to wrap your mind around if you want to try to address some of these more wiggity topics. And John Keel in The Eighth Tower talks about the idea of the concept of The Eighth Tower is that we complete a circuit that allows these things to manifest. So the human mind receives the frequency from the quote-unquote eighth tower that allows us to see this shit, and that's what it is. And we're like an antenna for it. That's how the human mind works. And one concept he talks about is that he's constantly chasing this similarity between sightings of cryptids, UFOs, which is people get pink eye, burns. They get these, they have this adverse effect. A lot of times, which we will also cover with when we talk about a little bit longer in this episode, people have health problems after experiencing these things.
Is it possible that people who tend to go looking for Bigfoot are naturally unhealthy?
I think they're the type of people that don't wash their hands after they wipe their ass.
It's very possible.
Why would I do that? Oh my God, I'll never forget. I watched a YouTube video about a woman screaming about how toilet paper is a fraud.
Oh God, it's not a fraud. It's there.
Well, she laughed at people who use toilet paper.
What? Does she own a bidet?
No.
No. She's not near me.
She's wiping her ass in a lake behind her house.
Oh, God. That's a retention pond.
Yeah.
But the concept of, all right, let's say these creatures, the Phantom Menagerie, comes about because the Eighth Tower is there projecting its beams, right? These things show up and they, like in Ghostbusters or Ray
Riddler.
Stans. Yeah, like, yes. Like when Ray Stans makes the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, right? That they, you know, he's like, I try to clear my mind. The only thing that came up in my head was the most innocent thing in the world was the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. Somebody who loves cats happens to see a big giant cat out there, right? Like it's like it pulled from the back of its subconscious. It created a big dopey cat, but it did for a moment exist physically. That it's actually not real though, like it is not a physical thing, but somehow
if I imagined like a great palm frite stand, and because I've been thinking about these palm frites with salt and vinegar, and they do it like that in Canada, would I be able to go then order some of the palm frites that I just created in my mind?
You might, but the problem is that in the moment you would seek to engage in this physical manifestation of this cryptid palm frites, it would disappear. Right, and they would talk about how these things disappear and go extinct. But a part of what he thinks is that the way they go extinct is that, weirdly, he thinks the particles, one theory he has is that the particles that make up these cryptids that we momentarily see are toxic to us. And that when they disappear, they disperse like the half-life of a radioactive element. And that particles from it shoot into us and poison us. Yeah.
Okay.
Whatever.
Whatever, but I mean, I hope it doesn't happen. I hope it doesn't.
I just
happen.
Thought it was fun. I was high as fuck, and I thought that was a great
idea. Well, I mean,
that's super fun.
It is super fun.
Yeah, fun I mean, to think about.
It is fun to think about.
Wrap your noodle around it.
Not
your dick.
It's a horrible thing to tell your doctor if you have cancer, and then you're like, "No, I don't think so. I think I know how I got this." And, you know, listen to medical advice. But that's an idea that you expressed.
Yes.
Yes.
On Holiday's estimation, one of the Phantom Menagerie that has gone extinct, never to return, is the Merrow, which, as far as I can tell, is a form of Irish mermaid. The Merrow, however, has not been seen in many years, unlike the seemingly ubiquitous Sasquatches and Chupacabras of modern times. And it could be that the Merrow has just fallen out of belief. There's not as many sailors as they used to be, not as many Irish people on the sea, so therefore, the Merrow does not show up in the Rolodex of human experience. But since we talk about Sasquatches and Chupacabra all the time, that shows up.
I'm just happy us redheads are getting some representation in the cryptid world. A redheaded, red mustached merman. How fun would that be?
Honestly,
oh, I love the Irish. Although, how do you smoke a cigar underwater? Or a pipe? How do you smoke a pipe underwater?
I mean, it just bubbles.
Yeah, it just bubbles.
Mm-hmm. But from what Holiday said, the Phantom Menagerie has been known to wise men for centuries, which is why the dragon, the Merrow, and the big black dog of yore are depicted so often in medieval churches. In Holiday's view, this was a form of insurance, with the church seemingly telling the Phantom Menagerie, "Hey buddy, we know you're out there." Therefore, by drawing pictures of, say, St. Patrick stomping on serpents and big cats, the church implies that it would be in the Phantom Menagerie's best interest to not challenge the creatures of Christianity, who are, ironically, also a part of the Goblin universe.
Maybe, what are they?
Hey there, Mr. Black Cat. Maybe when you think about when you decide to come for the church, maybe you don't want something bad to happen to you.
Are you Marlon Brando?
You want something bad to happen to you, Mr. Snake. Oh, it wouldn't be a shame if something happened to you, no legs. Try to come for the church.
I love it. One day Joe Pesci's going to die and you're going to get all of his roles.
I'm going to, please. But also, all of those paintings, they are allegorical. And I think there is, and there that's a part of this is he talks a little bit about the symbolism of the dragon as a part of the what the Jungian version of would be called the shadow of the personality, and that maybe there are elements of the goblin universe that are just protracted parts of our psychology, that and that's why we see these things, that it's something about this, and that if you really just talk about how the St. Patrick stomping on things like the big cats and the dragons, is that it's also about the imposed order that the Christians want to put on top of the old pagan religions, idea that we will crunch your symbols and roll it over with this essentially Irish pedophile.
Don't go crunching my symbols.
Where did you hear that St. Patrick is a pedophile?
Anybody who makes it to a saint has always had to do at least one big crime.
We don't know that he wasn't.
So after the Phantom Menagerie, Ted Holliday wrote of his own experience with a member of this flock, specifically when Ted participated in an attempted exorcism of the Loch Ness Monster.
This was a whole thing. This is the most adventurous part of
it. You can see the Loch Ness Monster turning its head all around, 360, spitting out a bunch of pea soup.
This is one of those, again, this is, Hellier did this really well, where he decided, he's like, okay, fuck it. If it is like a poltergeist ghost type thing, let's say the Loch Ness Monster is its own fucking ghost. What if we try to challenge it with an exorcism?
Ghost chum.
Ghost chum. And so they got this fucking guy. This guy that did this exorcism is another, he is a character.
Oh, yeah, man. Well, see, two ministers in Scotland had disagreed about the nature of the Loch Ness Monster, with one minister maintaining that the monster was a real physical being, while the other believed that it was a paranormal phenomenon. Oh. That is to say that it was actually, technically, the ghost of the Loch Ness Monster who had lived in the loch millions of years ago, a projection from the past into the future.
That's fucking cool.
They're just one-upping each other at this point.
Nah, bro, it's a fucking ghost.
It's the ghost
fucking
of the so they both agree the Loch Ness Monster lived.
It's a ghost of a dinosaur. Dinosaur's ghost. Why does nobody talk about, why can't dinosaurs haunt shit?
Yeah,
it
man.
It could be a fucking ghost of a dinosaur.
That's exactly what this is. This is an exorcism of a fucking ghost dinosaur.
That's awesome.
Now, naturally, Ted Holliday sided with the minister who believed in the paranormal projection theory, a one Reverend Dr. Donald Ormond. So the two of them connected and began discussing the nature of the monster and whether or not they could perform an exorcism on the creature.
I'm really surprised you did not talk about Donald Ormond's first job, which is that he is the head of the spiritual agency that for circuses. He is a circus exorcist. His job
what
is...
What was he exercising?
He would go to animals that were misbehaving. Woman? This is true. He would exorcise animals that were having problems in circuses. That was his whole thing. Like, tigers having an attitude problem?
Yeah.
He'd go in and go like, the power of Christ compels you, tiger. The power of Christ compels you. And that's what... That was his whole job.
Is that how he became a doctor?
He's a doctor reverend.
A doctor reverend.
Yeah,
okay.
Man. At the same time, Ted also came into contact with a couple of students who had been diving into Loch Ness on weekends to try and find Nessie herself. Apparently, they developed what Ted called toothache syndrome, which was a mysterious nerve condition that caused immense pain in the teeth. Holliday believed that this was connected to the goblin universe because he had found a precedent for toothache syndrome in ancient Babylonian texts. And the texts thus spake. And the worm said, "What do these dried bones to me? Let me drink amongst the teeth, and set me on the gums that I may devour the blood of the teeth, and of their gums destroy the strength. Then shall I hold the bolt of the door."
Are we talking like, what kind of worms are we talking about here?
No, worm is an old word for dragon. That's what they originally
can we say tremor? Like a tremor's worm with the big old teeth and stuff like that?
I guess. You can call it a worm, whatever. But worm is, but it was spelled W-U-R-M. It wasn't W-O-R-M, it was worm.
Weem.
Okay.
Also, they talk about this all the time because he lumps Loch Ness Monster into now what we know about the Mothman and what we know about what people even say about the Bigfoot, about Flatwoods Monster, is that these things, when you see them, bring bad luck. Yeah. That the Loch Ness Monster is an actual harbinger of doom. And then every time you see a cryptid, bad things happen to you.
I thought Bigfoot was good.
Bigfoot, well, certain societies believe him. There's, you know, he's called the wise man on the mountain. Some people believe that he is an ascended master. Some people believe that he is some form of future human that's sent to warn us of our damage to nature, damage to ecology.
It's not a future human. We're not getting hairier.
Look at me.
No,
I don't have wisdom teeth.
You're a past human. Marcus is the sign of the future. No totally hair on humans.
I don't have wisdom teeth, though. I'm human 2.0.
I'm very hairy from the waist down, though. Isn't that interesting?
Like a center.
His actual, the shaft of Marcus's dick is covered in hair.
Yeah. Top to bottom, my friend.
Yeah,
oh,
man.
Yeah,
are
yeah,
you
yeah.
kidding
I'm like
me?
I'm like a satyr, you know?
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
actually,
yeah.
actually, that is more like what I am. Yeah, I got the hairy goat legs and then nothing up top.
You have a
I'm
hairy
like a Greek.
Penis?
Yes, Ben, I have a hairy penis.
Got him.
I don't know.
Well, after meeting the students, in August of 1971, a Swedish journalist named Jan Ove Sundberg claimed to have seen an actual UFO on the shores of Loch Ness. He said that it was a gray-black cigar-shaped structure 10 meters long, and three figures, interestingly, dressed just like the creatures at Baikal Lake that we talked about last week, stepped out.
Spring collection, 1971.
I love that spring collection.
Afterwards, Sundberg claimed that he was visited by the good old Men in Black and suffered a nervous breakdown as a result. Of course, the Men in Black are also creatures of the Goblin universe. And so, with all this ooky spooky stuff going on, Ted Holliday and the Reverend Doctor decided to exorcise the Loch Ness Monster.
Man, I want to go out. I want to hang out with Ted Holliday.
No,
this is so much fun.
No, you don't. You would drive. Because it would be, honestly, Henry, it would be a reflection of what it's like to hang out with you. And I think that you would leave it with an understanding that you don't want to have.
You're a moron because I would, first of all, I find great restaurants. We would go out and we would have a fun time.
No, because you would argue because he has a different idea of what a great restaurant is. So he's going to take you to his great restaurant and you're not going to like it.
I honestly would like it if one of my friends put an effort into some of our events when we go out and travel.
Bro, I brought people to a baseball game last weekend. I
mean, and one of them almost died. Well,
we did have a friend that got violently ill from a Dodger dog. And thank God.
Lexi, we want you to
she
be okay.
She is doing okay.
On June 2nd, 1973, several people performed five rites at each corner of Loch Ness, with the main rite being performed in a boat in the center of the lake by the Reverend Dr. Ormond. From records, this is the exorcism that Dr. Ormond performed.
Hey, Grant, by the pure entrusted to thy unworthy servant, this Highland Loch, on the land adjourning it may be delivered from all evil spirits, all vain imaginations, projections and phantasms, and all deceits of the evil one. O Lord, subject them to thy servant's command, that at his bidding they will harm neither man nor beast, but depart to the place appointed them, there to remain forever.
How long do they stand there before someone's just like, all right, we gotta get at it. Okay. Like, how long do you stand there in dead silence when nothing happens?
Until it gets dark.
Until it gets dark?
I think until it gets dark, yeah.
You do it. Oh my
that's the
God.
Thing. You do it at dusk. So that way you know that it's going to get dark soon, so
okay,
you're not going to be out there too long.
You can't
you gotta
stay
get back
out there
before
long.
Dark.
Of course you do.
You know when someone, because like I used to go to like one Thanksgiving there where it's like everyone used to read like a super sincere poem before, like it was someone, it was like very
what?
Fancy.
This yeah, is I don't, a long I story. Never did that.
That sounds horrible.
I went to a thing, but everyone would read something about
everyone
like
just
the harvest.
Drinks a goblet of blood from the Native American.
I wish it was that metal. But we would sit there and everyone would read like something hyper sincere, you know, and they'd be like, and that way I fill the gourd that's in my heart. And then what you'd have to do is when they read something super serious, and then you have to kind of give it a beat where you go, okay. You know what I mean? Like, you just have to give it like a landing place. Every single time
someone
says, no,
I understand. All right.
Can we eat? Oh, no, you're going to read something about another poem about gourds.
Another thing about the gourd. All right.
So after the exorcism, Ted Holliday was thinking of wandering on over to where the Swedish journalist had seen the UFO. But when he saw a pyramid-shaped, 8-foot-tall column of black smoke through the window, just as his friend said, don't go see the UFO, he decided against it.
Yeah, because that was a part of the lake where people get getting scooped up by aliens.
Mm-hmm. Scary.
Later that same night, Ted and his hosts said that they had an encounter with circles of white light that danced around the room, and they all eventually landed on Ted's face, much to the terror of everyone present.
Get it off me! Get it off me! Get it off me! Get it off me!
All of his friends just taking the opportunity to punch him in the face.
No, no, I'm trying to get rid of the circle
of
light.
I'm doing it, man.
And then the next morning, a bona fide man in black was waiting outside for Ted. 6 feet tall, dressed in black plastic from head to toe, and wearing a helmet with gloves and goggles.
Okay, did he just get on the 6 train? Are we sure this man is a man in black or just a homeless man who needs someplace to rest?
It is 1973. There were some alternative fashions happening at the time, but this is in Loch Ness. This is out in the middle of Scotland, so it might be, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how fashion gets out there.
But from what Ted said, he had no visible eyes and he did not appear to breathe.
Hmm.
Oh.
The man in black then suddenly disappeared. And what made matters worse was that the exorcism was a complete and total failure. Because everyone just kept seeing the Loch Ness Monster.
But don't worry, Reverend Dr. Mr. Donald Ormond wanted them all to know it's quite possible this won't work. And he did say that at the very top. Okay. I will give him that.
Truth in advertising. That's very nice that he said the truth anyway.
But the kicker was that when Ted returned to Loch Ness the next year, he suffered a near-fatal heart attack in the exact same spot where the man in black appeared.
God damn.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Do they always get their man?
So after outlining the exorcism...
the man in black.
Yes, yeah, yeah. That's true. No, I just...
So after outlining the exorcism of Loch Ness, Ted Holliday takes a sharp left turn to talk shit on evolution for an entire chapter.
Yeah, wait, what?
It's just hard. This is the problem.
What are you talking about?
This is every one of these books where you like, cool, cool, cool. And then you're just like, God damn it. Now we're going to talk about how Darwin was a pedophile or something.
He just completely misunderstands the concept of evolution. He's like, if evolution is weird and real, then like, why don't we like see it like every day?
He has other like good ideas.
30 different coronavirus strands now or some shit.
Yeah. But he also is like, no, evolution's not the real deal. The real deal is bioelectric fields. That's actually the real deal here on Earth. So maybe you should look into that a little
this
bit.
This wasn't supposed to be published. It does not.
Because the book fucking falls apart in the last couple of chapters. And you can see why Ted Holliday wasn't too jazzed about releasing all this half-baked pseudoscience.
They all turn into Ray Stevens. The man who used to just sing funny songs, and then next thing you know, he's an Obama birther, truther, who just sang very horrible songs
about
race.
But it's the same, like, tunes as the children's song.
Yes, it's very scary.
Yeah, it's just like Guitar Zan, except it's about Osama bin Laden.
And it's a lot of hitting the Hussein, a Barack Hussein Obama heart.
Yeah.
But still, some of the ideas contained in the chapters before Ted Holliday bungles his biology certainly make the Goblin universe a compelling, if incomplete, addition to the study of the paranormal.
Wow.
I really do believe that you have to combine all of these things at once. I think it's important to have the ones that talk about the biological and scientific needs for evidence alongside all of this woo-wee-woo bullshit as well. Because I think that's the only way you'll really see the scope of how much energy these fat-bodied nerds have put into this subject and how it inspires other fat-bodied nerds to move the subject forward into the future.
I didn't really get the science in this one.
This is what we're doing. Science is all about an attitude.
Science.
It's a scientific attitude.
Well, I don't know about that.
But yes, all of these things, I mean, yes, does it make you a more difficult person to love? Sure. But it also makes you a hyper interesting person to at least 10 people that matter.
Well, and there you go. It's nice to have a close group of friends for the next pandemic. Okay. Well, this has just been fantastic. Thank you all so much for listening. We can't wait to see you all in Colorado. Oh, so that's coming up very soon.
Very, very soon. Next week, we have some real science coming at you. We're going to talk about something that is very real, and we're very, very excited about it. Here's some housekeeping. Number one, our stream. It's going to be live on Patreon starting on Monday.
Mondays.
5 p.m. EST. We're going to 5 p.m. PST. We're going to Mondays. Going to say that again. It's live on Patreon, and then it's going to go up live on Tuesday.
That's right. 8 p.m. if you're in the Eastern time zone, and 5 p.m. here in the West, and I guess 6 then if you're in the Central.
And we will put
seven.
Up a bunch
seven.
Of announcements.
Okay. 7 Central, 6 Mountain. You're thinking of Mountain.
So confusing, and I don't even want to think about time zones.
Time
unless
is,
you're in
time
Arizona,
is not real.
Unless you're in Arizona and you don't do daylight savings time, then everything's all wishy-washy.
They're really right about that.
They are right. It's the one thing they've been correct about. Remember, what have we learned? Time is not real, but schedules.
Schedules.
Are real. Schedules
appointments are real. Also are very real.
They that's
are
part of real. You put that in your schedule.
Put it right in there. You got to hold all of you. But I think it's important to hold all of these ideas in one. Because can't we, folks, are in our brains? Because the brains, they can hold the entire universe inside of them.
Well, most people have, they got to think about picking up their kids. And
whatever,
their lives.
Fuck these kids. Have them catch up. These kids should be working.
Well, again,
but
there
again,
are
you
got
to make sure they
reason.
Get to work on time.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. But that's why the public transportation systems need to be updated.
Well, now we've gotten to something truthful. Finally, it only took us damn near to the end. We could get some better public transportation.
High speed rail. Let's do it.
I love a high speed rail.
Well, you're in.
Come on, y'all. Learn how to use Narcan. We're going to be putting that out there.
Absolutely. All right, everyone. Well, thank you all so much for listening. Check out all the shows here on the Last Podcast Network. And we hope you're happy and safe and doing the best you can. We can't wait to see you on the road.
Check out every single show.
Please do. Honestly, I can safely say that all of the content on the network is really good. It's really fun. And everyone works really hard on the shows.
This week on No Dogs in Space, we are finishing our series on the Beastie Boys. The episode will be coming out this weekend. So if you've been waiting for the entire series to be out before you listen to the whole goddamn thing, you can. It's 6 episodes long. It's lot of information on the Beastie Boys, but we also go into like the history of hip hop and all kinds of other shit. We're very proud of this series. So
and
I would say
really
check it out.
And this one's really for the elder millennials out there.
Yeah, it really is. No. We finally get to the album that came out when we were in high school. Hello, Nasty.
Intergalactic planetary. Body moving.
Yeah, the beginning of the robot takeover. All right, everyone. Thank you all so much for listening. Hail yourselves.
Hail Satan.
Hail Gene.
Magusulations.
Hail me in all my forms, because I might appear to you as just a simple redheaded, bearded, portly man.
So I can change the way you look to me?
Do it.
It didn't work, dude.
Come on, man. Give me tits. Good ones. You see?
You don't know what I'm into.
Oh, God.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. Thanks to our ad sponsors, you can support our shows by supporting them. For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to lastpodcastnetwork.com.